This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 15th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 258 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards. We've got a great show for you today. We'll be ditching the travel guides and getting a first-hand look at the real Indonesia with author Elizabeth Pisani.
And we'll speak to the journalist and author Venora Bennett about her new book on Russia. We'll ask her where she thinks the country is headed.
Plus, it's challenging enough to try and pilot a small plane around the world in 30 days. But what if you're just 17 years old? We'll speak to the young pilot hoping to break the world record, all for a good cause.
And as always, we'll tell you everything you need to know about the coming week with our news look ahead. Alad John will join us right here in the studio.
It's a packed 258th edition of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards. Welcome to it. I wondered how many phrases we could get through before mentioning the elephant in the room. Tom.
What is the elephant?
Well, we can't really talk about the World Cup, can we? We'll leave that.
We shouldn't do it. I mean, it's, you know, I don't know whether
it's a tough one.
Cover it in a journalistic way, in a sports fans.
Sports fans
eye,
kind of way.
Or, you know, as a kind of socio-cultural, you know, piece of analysis.
There are many strands. But one thing we can safely talk about without fear of reprimand or getting it wrong is we can talk about the legendary Monocle sweepstake for the World Cup.
We can, Rob.
Which team did you draw in that?
Well, you always, you know, one goes into these things with a certain lightness of touch. You think it's all just in the name of fun. But I was delighted to see one of the real serious players come out in my favour. I've got Algeria.
Very nice,
so,
too.
So that game could come to a, I would say, fairly premature end for me. What about yourself, Rob?
I drew Russia, which, again...
Steady.
I don't even know how steady Russia are.
There's quite a lot of instability.
I guess I'm going to be studying my BBC Sport website to kind of see what I might do and whether I might potentially be able to get my money back.
You could try that. I've tried that already. No joy.
I've kept the
so
receipts.
Far.
What's wrong with that? And how's the rest of the week been, other than the excitement of the World Cup kicking off? And that obviously is second only to the Monocle sweepstake about the World Cup.
That's true.
How's the week been? It looks pretty busy.
It's been fairly busy.
Monocle 24 point.
It's always fairly busy on Monocle 24. It's an unforgiving paymaster.
Unforgiving mistress.
It is indeed. She treats me so badly sometimes, but I always come back for more. But what a nice week it's been. You know, it feels a bit like summer finally arrived.
The summer's happened. Summer's really happened. And on the sporting theme, it's things like, obviously, the sun coming out. But, you know, Queen's, the preliminary tournament. Wimbledon is on the TV. It's the first test is on as we speak.
And, the sound of leather. Leather and willow.
Leather and
those
willow.
Old cliches,
it's always
isn't it?
Nice to see the old egg and bacon
Absolutely.
Ties walking walking
up
Baker Street exactly to Lourdes, and then the World Cup kicks off. It couldn't be. It's great, and the sun's got his hat on. Hip 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 hooray!
It's been wonderful stuff.
I like this. I like it. Sort of very kind of leisurely introduction to the show. But it's now time for the news look ahead. I mean, this is really the niche that you've carved out for yourself. Alad John stepping into your shoes today.
Sparks are going to fly, I feel.
Sparks are going to fly. You're going to be tough on him. You're going to challenge him at every turn.
Let's see how he fares in the early rounds.
Okay, let's welcome him into the news bear pit. It's Monocle's Alad John. And here he is in his stripy Breton sort of gondolier's
outfit
shirt.
Yeah, well, exactly. I've actually just come out of my...
Nice boater.
Come out of the Monocle mascot, Monochan, because it's now a routine that I get into the Big Owl every summer or Christmas fair. And
what do you do in there?
It's a bit of an out-of-body experience, actually. It's kind of bizarre.
I've heard that you rather like it because it gives you anonymity. That's what you said to me.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know what you've been up to in there, but...
It's kind of existential. It's much like that. I haven't actually seen it, but from your interview with John Ronson, I can imagine it's kind of like Frank for Michael Fassbender, playing that guy inside the head. Because you get all up and close and personal with people and they don't really know who you are, and you can kind of flap your wings and move your tail. It's a bit bizarre.
It's a strange thing because Monochan's got a sort of very, I think, a smiley demeanour.
But inside,
with a lurking undertone of sexual menace. But but he's a very cuddly character. But inside, you know, it might be like the clown's makeup. Inside, that is. He might be basically very hot.
Monochan's his inner child is overheated and very, very emotional.
Well, it's like when you go to a festival or you just see someone in fancy dress who, completely out of character, is actually really angry or upset or having a fag.
Exactly.
It's raining and the makeup's streaming and underneath. Like, oh, God.
Oh, dear.
It's tough. But anyway, I've been in there. It's great outside, warm weather. Kids kicking me in the bum, dressed as an owl, obviously.
Okay,
it's part and parcel of the job. There's petting zoo. There's things being sold, sandwiches, toasties being made. You got the lovely artwork by Verge Brulé as well.
Oh, yeah, nice, yeah.
It's got a good crowd. You guys been out there yet?
Of course, yeah. I wouldn't miss it for anything.
I've been manning the welcome desk, so... I don't know.
Is there a tombola?
That's why there's only three people here.
Always a tombola.
We're all in the studio.
Get out.
Always a tombola, of course. So you can try your luck with that. But yeah, there's a few hours left. You know, the day is ticking by, but people can still get along. Why not?
It's fun. Come one, come all. Okay, so coming up this week in the news, it's not grim, but it's pretty serious stuff, gents. Where do you want me to start? I've got the first secret trial in British modern legal history.
Well, maybe we can start on that. Maybe we'll start close to home. We've been talking about Midori House. Let's start with that. That's This is unprecedented.
It is indeed. It's a major criminal trial expected to begin this week. It is actually subject to an appeal by some portions of the legal establishment who don't want it to go ahead because they see it as an affront to open justice, the sort of transparency of the legal system in the UK that the legal establishment is very proud of, rightly so. The trial is likely to be held, however, in secret for the first time in British legal history. This is to do with a terrorism trial, and the two men, I believe, known mysteriously as AB and CD.
I think the trial is to decide whether or not they are gentlemen. Which way does he pass the port? Did you cut the nose off the cheese?
I'm going to carry on with the news.
What does this involve? What are these gentlemen or not being accused of?
Well, we don't know. That's the point. It's completely secret. The journalists aren't allowed in.
But the idea is that, I mean, all the gossip is that it's terrorism charges, right? But we don't know what specifically that is.
It's not yew tree or something. This is serious stuff. Obviously, yew tree serious as well. Don't get me wrong.
I don't know where you've gone with that.
Well, strange ones. You can hang out with Monochan too much. Hang out with children's entertainers.
So it's my alter ego from being in the owl. interestingly, it will have a jury, though, which is an interesting point because there's all those elements that, say, with a kind of transparency in the courts, with things like Twitter being involved, that it comes to a point now in modern day, can you actually trust a jury not to look at the press or be influenced by certain external factors, such as what's happening in social media or what have you? The idea that the jury are going to be present during a trial which is secret from both the press, the public, and just the wider legal establishment, everything is going to be redacted in documents afterwards, whether or not they can be trusted to keep the peace, keep the truth silent.
Yeah, it's a kind of, this is a proper benchmark event, isn't it? I guess so. We'll keep our eye on that. What's next on the menu, Alad?
Should we go a bit lighter? We've got some lighter stuff. A couple of things to end. One thing to bear in mind, this week starts the beginning of the annual Cannes Lions International Festival, not of advertising anymore, but of creativity.
Mm.
It's fairly
a nebulous phrase.
Yeah, I know. I actually interviewed someone the other day about it, and he was one of the agencies that's going to be there. It was really vague stuff. I have to be honest.
He was from an ad agency, a creative agency?
Yeah, he was a creative director from an agency based in Hong Kong, but exhibiting stuff at Cannes. And I was trying to push him on the idea of what's the substance behind this. It's effectively a rebrand of the Cannes Festival of branding.
It's funny, isn't it? It's a bit Emperor's New Clothes, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like, is this new snake oil? We're just calling it creativity now because brands are thought to have to deliver much more for the customer, whether it's print campaigns, online ads, what have you. The whole kind of snake oil thing is that we can do more for you other than just advertising, but at the end of the day, it's basically just advertising. I don't know.
You've pulled the scales have fallen from my eyes, Alad.
Pulled the blood.
It's been a revelation.
Exactly. Yeah.
But you never know.
Cannes Lions Festival of Creativity is coming up. That's rubbish. but it is one of those things. This is sort of a bellwether for the creative industries. Yeah. How many people turn up, how seriously it's taken, how international is it? All these things kind of can't help but be interesting. But as you say, it is. I wonder how it varies from the proper kind of like the go-getting kind of slightly more old-school advertising festival.
Yeah. I think it's like any of those festivals. There's really interesting stuff happening there, but you just need to find it within the kind of murky waters of like you said, nebulous
sort
of blurb.
Yeah.
But so, I'm sure this time next week we'll probably find out if anything of note has happened.
There'll be some good
Sense Alan's not a big fan.
Yeah, slightly.
Sorry, guys. Okay, on a more optimistic note, Rob, you're like this as culture editor. This is an auction from Christie's with some real big hitters. This is a group of, let me see the details here. We've got Christie's in London holding its Impressionist and Modern Art evening sale. The rich offering, their words, of 60 avant-garde and modern works by the towering greats of the 20th century. So you got some Giacometti. I think he's actually got one of his. This one's called La Main, conceived and cast in 1947, which was in the New York exhibition that launched his post-war career. So there's some really interesting stuff there. You've got some Pierre Mondrian from the Rudolph and Leonore Blum collection. These artworks are fetching in the realm of 10 to 15 million a piece. That's for the Giacometti. That's one of his pieces. 5 to 8 million pounds for the Mondrian. You've got some Kurt Schwitters there.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah. These are all kind of proper blue chip stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always the modern that's the safe bet rather than the contemporary, because you don't know. These people are dead mostly. You know, they've kind of earned their worth in the canon kind of stuff. So these the Mondrians and Schwitters and things. These worlds are kind of the ones to put your hand up for, Allard.
I will go there and raise my. What do you call it? Paddle?
Where's your owl's wing?
Bonachan, the big mover again this year.
Obviously, the World Cup's going on. What stage are we going to be at by the end of this week coming?
Oh, I don't know.
It's still group stages.
It's all groups. Yeah, it's all group stages still. So,
we were talking earlier. And, go Algeria.
Yeah. Who have you drawn in the sweepstake? Alan?
Honduras.
Oh, I've got Russia. I think we'll all be taking an early bath.
Yeah. A bunch of stinkers.
Alan, thank you very much for the news look ahead. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards. Now, Indonesia is a nation of contrast. Jakarta is a sprawling metropolis with high-rise towers and millions of people crammed into an overcrowded space. But head out into the Sumatran forests and you'll find superstition, ancient rituals, and black magic.
The country is spread across more than 13,000 islands. One in 30 people on the planet is Indonesian. It's as diverse as you might think. The investigative journalist Elizabeth Pisani set out across the country to discover the real Indonesia. And along the way, she met with a presidential candidate who keeps a posse of albino dwarfs, to those that want to ban Lady Gaga. Those are just a few of the stories Elizabeth writes about in her new book entitled Indonesia, Etc. And we're delighted that she joins us now. Elizabeth, thanks for being on the show. I mentioned there this huge number of islands, a huge number of people, and spread over this incredible area. I just wonder how difficult it is to characterise a country that is so disparate. What are the strands that pull it all together? Did you have a fair idea of what they'd be before you started writing the book?
I first started working in Indonesia in, God, this is going to age me, isn't it, in the late 80s. So I've been thinking about this for quite a long time, and I have to say, having worked there on and off for 20 years, having lived there for 8 years, and having spent the last 13 months travelling around the outer islands, I'm not that much closer to knowing what those strands are. I mean, it really, the diversity is so extraordinary. You've got sort of, in the far west, very, very heavily Arab-influenced Muslims with very Arab characteristics in their features, in their cuisine. And then in the Far East, you've got Melanesians who are black-skinned, curly-haired, nominally Christian, still extremely tribal, and everything in between. So it's really quite interesting when we're thinking about nationhood to think what makes all of those people Indonesian. The single characteristic that really is most spread across the nation is hospitality. The Indonesians are the most hospitable people on the planet, I think, which makes it a very easy place to travel.
And it's an interesting thing. You talked about the spread, the disparity of race, belief, and obviously the geography. It's a huge country. Or it's an amazingly wide country. Do people in the West and the people in the East think of themselves as Indonesians? Is it a sort of a monoculture, at least in that sense?
Not at all. They do think of themselves as Indonesians when the national football team is playing against Malaysia, but that's just about the only time. It's a bit like, you know, you get Andy Murray being Scottish until he's winning Wimbledon and then he's British. It's slightly that. It's almost become more disparate recently because, as I'm sure you know, Indonesia was very heavily centralized under a 32-year dictatorship, which ended in the late 1990s. So President Suharto, who'd been in power for over 30 years, was pushed out. And since then, there's been this phenomenal blossoming of democracy. And part of that has been this decentralization. So all the local cultures, which had been sort of forced into a national mold during the Suharto years, are now rediscovering their traditions and sometimes reinventing them. It's quite funny. You go out to an island in the middle of the Maluku Islands in eastern Indonesia, for instance, and you'll see these strange dances and rituals and music, and you'll ask the old people, so tell me about this, and they're like, I think the culture department made it up so that we could have our own festival. I mean, it's that sort of... it's a blossoming, but it's certainly being helped along for political reasons.
Elizabeth, tell us something about some of the characters you meet along the way. We sort of alluded to some of them in the introduction. It's an incredible cast of characters. I guess inevitably when you talk about the sort of diversity of people that you're going to meet. I wonder, as you were doing your travels and talking with them, were there moments when you really felt you met somebody who was, if you like, the real embodiment of what it was to be in Indonesian? Were there perfect moments that you felt, wow, when I commit this to the page, this will go some way to kind of encapsulate what I'm trying to bring across to people?
Tragically, there are 240 million different encapsulations because people are so different. But as I said before, hospitality is a really key thing, and helpfulness. It was one very, very funny time when I was traveling. I traveled mostly alone for a year, and just for a couple of weeks, I had a friend with me who's a French criminologist who works in the Jakarta nightlife. And we were in the eastern island of Sumba, and we wanted to witness these ritual jousting sessions. So villages, all the young men of villages get up on their horses, and they joust in these great swirling circles, and where the circles intersect, they try and essentially kill one another. And it goes back to an ancient tradition where spilling blood guarantees a good harvest and all this colorful thing. So it was very wonderful and colorful. But finally, my friend was like, you know what? I'm on holiday and I just want to go to the beach. Fair enough. He's been indulging me with all this sort of esoteric culture. So we go back to the motorbike that we've driven 45 kilometers off the nearest serviceable road to get to this jousting place. And he's lost the key. No key. So we're on a 4-acre site with hundreds of people stampeding horses. No, we haven't been sitting down anywhere. He's like, oh, which bush did I pee behind? Which lady did I buy some water from? You know, desperately trying to retrace our steps to find the key to this motorbike. It was worse than a needle in a haystack. So finally, we just decided to do what we both knew best. As a criminologist, he's looking for the toughest crim-looking guy around so that he can hotwire the bike. And I just go up to the local chief of police, who's there as one of the local dignitaries, and say, oh, I'm so sorry, it's so embarrassing, but this has happened, blah, blah, blah. And the local chief of police calls back. Everyone's already beginning to leave. He calls the truck with all the cops back from the road, says, can you help them, please? We load up into the truck. We go, they say, which is your bike? We point out the motorbike. They lift the motorbike into the police truck, drive us back to town, and take us to someone who will make a fake key for us. And you're like, wow, in which country in the world will the cops help you steal your bike? The funny, when we did it, Jerome looks across at me, he's French, and he said to me in French, do you know, we should have chosen a nicer bike.
Yeah. Yeah, mine's the Bentley. It sounds like a very encouraging thing that Indonesians are so friendly to foreigners, reporters, to you writing a book or just being a tourist. Are they friendly to each other? You mentioned the sort of east-west, not necessarily a divide, but are they friendly to each other?
That's an interesting question. In general, the reason I think that people are so friendly is that it's a string of islands that runs between the two great manufacturing and trading hubs of the world historically, between China and India. So since the beginning of time, there have been traders coming through on ships, and they go between islands. And so people are very, very accustomed to seeing foreigners, including, you know, now these foreigners would be called Indonesians, but people from other islands, people with other religions, people with other colors and other languages. People are used to that diversity, and it goes on now in Indonesia. There's a lot of internal migration, but not just recently, it's been going on for some time, but increasingly recently, there have been clashes between people who are migrants from other islands within Indonesia and people who are rooted in the soil of a certain island. So in some of the larger islands, such as Kalimantan, which is the Indonesian part of Borneo Island, there have been some quite nasty clashes between the indigenous Dayak populations and some of the immigrant populations who've come from other islands to seek their fortune. So there is always this possibility for friction. It usually occurs when a group of people from another island with new technology, with new ideas, who are prepared to work harder because they're immigrants. It's the immigrant experience the world over, I think. But it's interesting in Indonesia because it's all within one country. So just as in London, you're complaining about Polish plumbers if you're a British plumber who likes to have a tea break every 20 minutes, it's sort of the same thing, except in Indonesia, your Polish plumbers are also Indonesians.
And in terms of its image of itself, obviously there's a lot of, as always, there's a lot of sort of nationalism springing up all over the world. And is that, how safe a concept and as a cogent sort of unity is Indonesia, do you think, therefore?
As is often the case with nationalism, it surfaces when it's challenged. So if you ask most Indonesians where they're from, they'll tell you their ethnic group or their island. I'm Javanese, I'm Minangkabau, or whatever it is. But if you challenge them, if there's a challenge to Indonesia's dignity or identity, for example, there are quite often spats with neighboring Malaysia, or there's a huge population of Indonesians who work overseas in the Middle East, particularly, both as domestic and as construction workers. And if there's a story of an Indonesian construction worker or domestic worker being mistreated, for example, in Saudi, then there's a huge national solidarity. Also, when something happens in Indonesia itself, for example, with the tsunami of 2004, which really hit just the far western provinces in Aceh and North Sumatra, there was a huge coming together of the nation around that real need of just one part of the population. So I think the nationalism is there, but it's not very evident most of the time. It only sort of surfaces with a challenge, which is not necessarily a bad thing, is it?
Elizabeth, you obviously have such a sort of deep knowledge and understanding of the country that you've garnered from your time there and from your travels. I just wonder, looking to the future, is it going to be, do you think, a story of similar contrasts and similar tensions, maybe the tensions between old and new, modern and ancient, because you have these extraordinary metropolitan areas, you know, big, huge cities, mega hubs like Jakarta, and then you have this, you know, often this very, a lot of ancient tradition and this kind of thing. Are they going to be in clashing forces, do you think, as the country changes and develops, or do you think it's actually a place that's rather well set and actually very sort of at ease with itself and what it's becoming?
I think it is remarkably at ease. Indonesians have a remarkable ability to be flexible and essentially to hold two ideas in their head at any one time. So there's people who are working in super modern conditions with a Western education and who come out with these superstitions, or who, when they're back in their family environment, fall back into rituals that you'd think, wow, I would have thought you would have given that up. Just as some very good scientists are also, are strong Christians, for example, or strong Catholics, and you think, gosh, isn't it odd that you can believe that you're eating the body and blood of Christ while you're working on DNA, whatever. The Indonesians are very able to hold multiple worldviews at the same time. And I think that will probably allow the nation to be quite resilient as it moves forward. It's really delightful that there's these different worlds sort of coexisting, often in the same place at the same time. So you have people who are chanting in a language that is understandable only to the high priests, and other people who are recording that on their cell phones and then going to sleep playing the chants to themselves on their cell phones. You think, that's quite a good coexistence of ancient and modern, I would have thought.
I think that sums it up nicely. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly. The book is Indonesia, Etc., Exploring the Improbable Nation. It's published by Grant, and it's very personal and universal, I think. Elizabeth Pisani, thank you very much for joining us.
At the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, these are something we'll be hearing a lot of over the 4 weeks of the tournament. But what are the alternative national songs that bind the nations taking part in the World Cup together?
There is one song that every South Korean knows, and that is the old folk song, Arirang.
We can dissent with our country, but we can be patriotic while doing it.
Monocle 24 brings you a series of special reports on the unofficial anthems that capture the spirit of the 32 nations battling it out in Brazil.
When people come out with some Advance Australia Fair, everybody kind of looks at each other and thinks, what country is that? Whereas if it's Waltzing Matilda, no problem. Waltzing Matilda
with me. That's the World Cup's alternative national anthems throughout the World Cup here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards. Now, we've all seen news coverage of the crisis in Ukraine over the last few months and an increasingly more aggressive and assertive Russia. One journalist who's covered the country for the past two decades is Venora Bennett.
Venora has covered everything from the Chechen War to the post-Soviet illegal caviar trade. She has a new novel out entitled The White Russian, set amongst the Russian emigre community in 1937 Paris. I asked her about the new book a little earlier. Venora, welcome to The Weekly. Thanks very much for coming to speak to us. We'll talk about the book, The White Russian, in a bit more detail in a moment. But I wanted to just start off by asking you in general terms, I suppose, about the challenge of writing fiction, writing novels based upon experiences, because it's something that a lot of writers attempt to do. Some might say not always successfully. What are the secrets? Because there are a lot of journalists in particular who've had some incredible experiences and they find it rather tricky to convey some of those complexities and nuances into the fictional narratives. Why do you think you've been able to do it to such great effect?
Well, that's very kind of you to say that. It is definitely incredibly difficult to swap from writing in a non-fiction sort of way, as journalists do, to writing fiction. And I remember the first time that I had a go, my agent kept sort of nagging me to try my hand at fiction, and I was going, nonsense, I'm a journalist, I can't do that. You know, they're two different things. And she made me write the first a few chapters to show her, and I was so embarrassed by the idea that you had to put feelings in or kind of why people did things, that I put them all in brackets, and she rang me up, she was laughing on the phone and said, the novel is the part in the brackets. And so I realised that you've really had to kind of turn things upside down. Over time, I've got better at knowing that the part in the brackets is what you've got to focus on. I thought of historical novels as a way where you could still have some facts, where you had to research a period and where you'd have something to cling on to that wasn't just your imagination. But I felt less and less kind of that was helpful, and more that it might be a constraint, and my books have got more modern as a result, maybe. But I've reached the 1930s now, who knows where next.
So tell me then, when we go back to your all the different places that you worked, I mean, it's an extraordinary career. Did you ever think that you saw things in a sort of a writerly way. Were you ever aware then of that, that beyond the sort of objectiveness that a journalist must of course have when writing and reporting and recording information, were you aware that there was something there that enabled you to see this sort of bigger picture, this writerly narrative, or was it very much something that you sort of came to later, if you will?
I don't know. I think, I mean, when you're in some place that is very far from home, you do spend a lot of time thinking, how can I possibly explain this to my mum or whoever it is? And in fact, people always tell you when you're a sort of rookie journalist that you've got to think about telling your mum or someone, your dog. And so you do spend a lot of time sort of working out how to articulate stuff. And it's not so much whether you approve of North Korea if you happen to be there or whatever. It's not a kind of value judgment. It's just like, why are these people wearing those funny shaped hats, and what's it for, and does it seem normal to them? And so it's all the incidental details. And if you can work out some way of conveying whatever it is and its importance to your home self and others at home, then that's half the battle. But you get into a mindset where you start doing that automatically. And so even when you go home, you're sort of going, why do my little boys like Arsenal so much? And then these things all become the beginning of a story.
That's a crying shame. We'll draw a veil over that one. let me just go back then through your career and sort of migration, working in Cambodia or across Africa, and including documenting some pretty difficult and complex times. If you're writing about, you know, really terrible events, very difficult, challenging things to witness, let alone document articulately for readers around the world, do you have to change your strategy? How aware are you? I mean, same almost a stupid question, as the environments change and those dynamics change, that you have to tailor your own writing, your own approach to your journalism or to your literary craft as you go? Or do you try and actually connect back to something that is consistent and doesn't change? And maybe therein lies the strength of it to a degree.
I'm thinking that when I worked at the LA Times, the editors had something called the California breakfast test, which was, if it was too disgusting for people to read over breakfast, that it wasn't going to get in the paper. And I suppose you tailor to the extent that, you know, you don't count the limbs and the torn off toes and that sort of thing. I don't know. I mean, life, I'm thinking of all kinds of probably too literary things to say, but
it's a really interesting and sort of complicated.
I've been reading the Hannah Arendt's book, The Banality of Evil, which is about Eichmann, and its burden is the banality of evil, and that people are terribly ordinary. You meet them, and he was this sort of funny little man who was, I think, thinking about joining some sort of dining society for postmen, and then his cousin turned up and said, actually, there's this really good thing, the Nazis, and they have much better dinners, and so he became a Nazi. Things happen for stupid reasons, and quite often, however horrible a thing looks from far away, you're up close and it's all the little banal details that you're still noticing, in the same way that, you know, a disaster happens in London of some sort or in any city, and people are always ringing up and saying, are you all right? And the people who are actually there are just going, well, of course, it didn't happen to me. It seems further away. So yeah, it's that sort of texture of close up that seems interesting when you are there. So I suppose you do always tailor things, but it seems to come about naturally and organically.
Let's talk a little bit then about the White Russian. You mentioned this sort of cycling through these historical periods in your books. What brings us to the era in which we find our protagonist in this narrative unfolding? Why have you alighted here on your historical journey?
I love Russia, and I spent a long time living in Russia in the 90s, and I now lead a kind of relatively domesticated, normal life with a family in London. But I've gone on being very fascinated by Russia, but I tend to prefer my kind of fantasy Russias. And real Russia is quite different now than all sort of glitzy and garish and very rich in the large cities anyway. And I don't know, it just feels like another foreign country to me. But this was a sort of quite good fantasy for me. I was always really interested by people who are exiled, people who are uprooted from whatever place they called home by some sort of disaster. And I spent a lot of time as a journalist covering things situations where there were refugees and talking to them. And I was just fascinated by the stuff that you carry away, the way that your memory works of those sort of moments of fear and anxiety, and how you reconcile yourself afterwards. I don't think many of them had psychotherapy in those days. the things that you have to do, the things that a human mind will do to be able to go back to leading a kind of boring life, which is what we all want. And there were hundreds of thousands of Russians who fought on with the White Army or who were hangers-on, who left Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution. And they had the classic refugee experience. They went to Constantinople and then they kind of worried about papers and they shuffled all around Europe and they sang sad songs in dingy nightclubs. And 200,000 plus ended up in Paris, where all these people, I mean, very romantic and picturesque, that sort of grand dukes were serving you in sleazy restaurants and princesses were sewing your clothes in fashion houses or modelling them. But it was all the other people, the kind of lesser people, the batmen and footmen who had gone to work in the Renault car factory and the pissed off Parisians who were saying, these people are taking our jobs. And so I just really wanted to write something kind of bringing that world to life.
It's always interesting when you talk about writing about art or music or these sort of very edifying and enlightening things, even against a backdrop which may be of migration in a previous your previous book, talking about the family of violin makers in Midnight in St. Petersburg, which then also inspired you as sort of life imitating art, imitating life, to explore restoring a violin. Is there anything of that character which you're taking away from this latest novel? Has it influenced you in ways perhaps that you never would have imagined when you set out to write the book?
Well, it's sort of a bit of six of one and a half a dozen of another, that at the same time, no, before I started doing it, but it sort of carried on into it. I was doing that kind of middle-aged thing that people often do of looking up my own family and sort of going through Ancestry.com. And a lot of this story is about an American girl trying to find out everything about her grandmother, who, although American, is living in Paris and hanging out with white Russians. But there's a, you know, there's a cache of letters, and she's trying to sort of establish what went on in the past to make the things that have happened in the present happen. So it was kind of historical ancestry.com. And that was really, I mean, my own experience definitely informed that, because as soon as I looked things up, I found that all our family stories were not wildly wrong, but they were all inaccurate in some way, and everything wasn't quite as the legend had solidified itself into being. And it was much more interesting, but much more uncertain. And I was quite keen to explore that, because in a way that's what happens with emigres, and they tell stories and it all solidifies into a particular way. It can only be told one way, and that's when it stops hurting, their past experience. But the truth will always have been more complicated. But I think it probably happens with everyone looking into the past, that there's only one version that survives time. But if you go back into the previous time, things were all much more interesting, messy, and full of possibilities.
They were indeed. Venora Bennett, the book is The White Russian. It's published by Century. Venora, thanks very much for coming to tell us all about it.
Thank you very much.
That was Venora Bennett, author of The White Russian, speaking to Tom a little earlier. It's time now for a track. Tom, should we have something new from First Aid Kit? Those Swedish sisters who sound like they're straight out of Nashville, but they're straight out of Gothenburg.
Sounds like Audio Gold. What would you recommend?
Well, this is from their new album, and I think this is on our playlist generally, but let's cue it up this afternoon. This is Silver Lining. That was Silver Lining from First Aid Kit, from their new record Stay Gold. Rush out and buy that, I would. It's absolutely fantastic, Tom.
I might do that. The other thing I might rush out and do, Rob, is explore getting my pilot's license.
Oh, yeah? Because what have you got? Why would you be mentioning such a thing?
Because I think we're going to speak to someone who already has one, despite being just the tender age of just 17 years old. He's going to fly around the world in 30 days to break the world record, and we'll be hearing from him in a moment.
Cool.
It's a green thumbs up from us for Tokyo's leading flower market and auction, where merchants indulge in the business of buying blooms.
The Japanese flower market is the place for perfectionists. Anyone looking for a branch of cherry blossom just before it flowers, or a blemish-free orchid with every flower facing the same way.
Blooms or Bust, a photographic essay on the Otta Flower Market, now showing in the film section on Monocle.com.
We Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards. Many of us know how dreadful it can be to go on long-haul flights, but imagine setting yourself a challenge to fly yourself around the world in just 30 days in a small prop plane. Not to mention, you're only 17 years old. Well, that's exactly what our next guest is doing.
Hara Suleiman is attempting two world records, one to become the youngest person in command of a flight around the world, and two, fly around the world in just 30 days. The reason, well, it's all for a good cause. We were expecting to have Hara join us here in the studio today, but because of an unexpected problem with his plane's engine, he's still stuck in Indiana, and he joins us now. Hara, thanks very much for joining us. Hopefully that's not a portent. You've had a few technical problems. I just wonder, how much of a fear is that when you're about to embark on this extraordinary journey? Is it dominated by fears of technical problems, or are you pretty sanguine about all of that kind of thing?
We've been prepared for quite a while now. Things usually go wrong in planes. It's all standard. We can fix them as we go, but it's actually just flying over the ocean and sitting in a upright position for that long that I'm worried about.
So basically, you need to take a cushion, is what you're saying. And give us, maybe you can paint a little picture for our listeners. We'll talk about the route, which is fascinating and obviously hugely long, in a minute. But tell us about the plane. What does it look like? Is it some sort of, is it a plane that's been specially designed for this purpose, or is it something standard that you're going to have to obviously make lots of stop-offs for refueling, etc.? What's it going to look like?
Well, it doesn't look like a lot of jets that people usually fly in. It's a single-engine propeller plane. It's called a Beechcraft Bonanza. And it's kind of a sport plane, but usually in the civil aircraft sector. And that's pretty much all it is.
Is it something that's built for endurance, or is it something that's built for speed, Harris?
Oh, it's built for speed. It's quite a remarkable airplane. We're carrying about 247 gallons in the plane, actually. And so we've actually modified it to where it'll work to our advantage of flying around the world.
And Horace, it's interesting. I mean, I know you're sort of getting ready for this, but I wonder, just over the last sort of few years, since you were 8 years old, I understand you've been flying with your father. What's the response of people, you know, when you're, you know, in school, for example? I mean, most people are worrying about, you know, what they're going to be doing on Saturday night or things like this. Maybe, you know, if they're going to get in the team for the big ball game on the weekend. And you're talking about flying around the world and breaking all of these records. Do people treat you any differently, or are you still got your same friends? Has things changed or not changed that much?
Well, I've been going to the school for a long time, and all my friends have known that my dad's the pilot and that he also landed a plane on the highway. So they're not really surprised when they hear about some of the endeavors we take part in our planes. And they're really proud, honestly, and the community is really helpful and supportive.
Now let's talk about the route then, Harris. You're going from Greenwood, Indiana, where I guess we're talking to you today, to Goose Bay in Canada. There's some good names in this list. Then you're going to Reykjavik. Then you're going to somewhere near our studios here. You're going to Biggin Hill, which is down on the south coast in Sussex, isn't it? You're going all over the place, Aswan, Egypt, etc., etc., etc. Tell us about the route. Why is that specifically the route? Is that about fuel stops, or is that about places you want to tick off on your list of must-sees?
It's partly fuel stops as well as places we would love to go. Egypt, we want to go because we'd love to see the pyramids, the Nile. Just Egypt is just a really rich place in terms of history and things to see. I would love to see Bali and Hawaii because they're just beautiful places and they're really nice to be. And I would love to be in England during the World Cup to watch the matches from there.
I'm sure we can smuggle you into a pub. We'll give you our number at the end of the show. And obviously, you are making a couple of stops. You're making three stops, I think, in Pakistan, Harris. And this is one of the reasons why you're doing the trip, isn't it? Tell us about the charity element of it.
So we support this organization called the Citizens Foundation. TCF is the abbreviation for it. Since 1995, they've been building schools in Pakistan for the public school sector. There are currently 6.5 million kids of the age to go to basic level education, but they are not enrolled. The aim of this organization has been to send them to schools and create schools for them. This year, they'll created their 1,000th school, and they will have sent 146,000 students to school. And so we would like to raise awareness and also celebrate the fact that they've made such a huge progress in the last few years.
And Horace, it's obviously for a very good cause, and you're clearly very passionate about the endeavour of flying. I just wonder, it seems like these kind of almost adventures, we don't see them so often. There was a spirit of the age, perhaps, with adventurers who used to try and tackle these things, flying around the world, testing their limits, and it doesn't seem to happen so often now. Do you think it's a problem that people, especially maybe parents of children as they grow up, actually protecting them too much and not allowing them to go out and try and have these adventures and push the limits of what they can achieve? Do you think people are a bit too cautious these days?
Of course. People really are afraid to leave their comfort zone and really step out into the other boundaries of the world. And really, that's kind of the shackles that we're stuck to. And so my parents have always emphasized that I need to step out of the boundaries and really explore what I want to do. They really helped me get into flying. And whatever I want to do, they're always supportive of, which has helped me a lot.
And let's just go back, before we go, Horace, to the journey itself. You sound like a very confident guy, but there's must be a little bit of trepidation, a little bit of a wobbling bottom lip about some of these legs, because there's a 13-hour leg, and you mentioned this is from Hawaii to California. Are there any parts of this journey between cities or between countries, over sort of patches of land or water perhaps, that represent a great challenge to a pilot?
What stands out for me is actually what you just said, Hawaii to California. That's 2,100 miles in about 13 hours. So that's really the one I've been thinking about mostly. And what I'm going to do on all those hours of just sitting there.
What are you going to do then? Are you allowed to presumably you need to be in constant kind of contact or have the ability to be in constant contact. You can't just stick your iPod on and chill out for 13 hours. You've got to be in control of this thing. Presumably concentrating is part and parcel of it. You obviously have to train long and hard just to keep focused on the job, right?
Yeah, well, we'll also have autopilot. That'll do quite a bit of work. And then after we set that, we'll just watch the plane, make sure everything's set and the fuel management.
And presumably, you need some stories to sustain you while you're doing the trip, presumably the two of you up there in the cockpit. But it's clearly the kind of thing that will have an amazing life-changing effect, not just on you, but presumably on these school kids in Pakistan, right?
Yes.
Cool. Well, Harris Suleiman, thank you very much. And tell us, because people are going to want to be able to follow your progress around the world, where can they do that? And when do you actually kick the prop into life and get going?
We plan to get going in the next week, on next Wednesday, actually. If people want to, they can follow me on my Twitter page, because people love Twitter. Mm-hmm. It's at World Rounder. That's my Twitter handle. As well, we have a blog. The blog is Fly Around the World in 30 Days.
Thank you very much, Horace. That was Horace Suleiman speaking to us about his journey around the globe, and we wish him the best of luck. And there we have it, Tom. That was the 258th edition of the Monocle Weekly.
We were flying, literally and metaphorically, all around the globe, weren't we, on that edition?
Yeah. That was a fascinating thing. I particularly liked Elizabeth. I think that's a great book. It's a great idea trying to put into words this kind of crazily disparate, huge country. One thing we didn't say in the interview, but which our listeners might be interested to know, is that from the west to the east of Indonesia is the same distance as London to Tehran.
I mean, that is absolutely...
And they're all one country.
It's just extraordinary, isn't it? And there's so much, there's these many millions, probably, of square miles of oceans all amongst it. It's amazing. And you actually alluded to this when you were talking to Elizabeth. The book itself is a joy to behold, and it has these sort of gatefold maps that, again, has some authentic sound effects.
Nice.
It's a said map, capturing the scale. And it's just the idea of having Thailand and Cambodia at one end of a map, Philippines in the north, and then Australia at the other side. It just makes you realise the sort of incredible expanse of Indonesia. It's amazing that it's held together as an entity at all, I think.
Yeah, like, I kind of love it. I love the fact that things can be so difficult, so different, rather, in one country. I think it's sort of fascinating.
Amazing.
Stuff. I can't quite want to go there.
I'd like to go there as well.
I might pack my bags.
I'd probably go to Borneo or Sumatra, because I'm a fan of the orangutan.
The orangutan, yeah.
It means old man of the jungle or something.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I'd like to go and hang out.
There's no orang. It's not because they're orange.
No. Well. I mean, I didn't used to think that.
I still think that. Okay, well, let's edit that out.
I believe it means.
No, they won't.
I believe it means orange monkey.
Orange Utan. I don't know what that is. Jungle Man.
Jungle Man. So it's not old.
Oh,
man.
Is that right?
Oh, Jungle Man, not Old Man of the Jungle. Man, jungle today. I should be like Orang, Greater Metropolitan Area. I've completely lost my train of thought now.
Pardon me.
Yeah, orangutans in those two. So that's where I'd go, Borneo or Sumatra.
I'd join you there. I wouldn't mind seeing an orangutan, hanging out with an orangutan, giving one a high five. I've got a, you know, Cheetah, the orangutan that was he in Everywhere Which Way Went Loose and films like that.
Yeah.
I've got a painting by him.
Really?
Yeah. Well, after he retired, the person that was his keeper.
Kept him busy.
Who a friend of mine knows. Kept him busy by making him paint things. And it's a really weirdly lovely picture.
Well, I was going to say,
it's
got his signature. Sort of, is it a figurative work or what?
it's a still life. It's very much like a Dutch master.
He was very into naive art. That's amazing. What was his signature?
His signature is his finger. And it's really lovely to see that, the orangutans, the worlds and details of his fingerprints.
That's
it's
amazing.
Kind of really rather lovely.
What a wonderful thing. Yeah, I'd like to see that one day.
Yeah, it's nice. I'll bring it in, shall I?
Super.
Well, when you pop round.
I'll just drop round and look at some orangutan art.
Exactly.
As you do.
Should we thank the chaps behind the glass? Today's show is produced by Phil Hahn and our studio manager is Toby Hammond. We should also thank Harriet very much for helping us out. But for now, from the time being, go Algeria. Go Russia. You know why we're saying that.
Go home, I think it's going to be.
From me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.